is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Well, today, the President of the United States, President Barack Obama, is asking Congress to give him three-year authority to fight a war. Now, he's been fighting that war for 6 months or more. We're talking about against ISIL or ISIS or whatever in Syria and northern Iraq. But we've been doing it largely from the air. And a poignant piece over at The Guardian today about a young man whose father was killed by a drone strike, and then he was killed by a drone strike. And one of the things that they point out in that piece is that Al-Qaeda runs the local region where this kid lives, or lived. He's dead now. And they provide people with a little tag with a flag on it for their mirror so that they can say, yeah, I'm in with the local government. And then they provide them with food and housing subsidies and things. I mean, who's not going to want that? And you know, obviously the 13-year-old, 14-year-old kid, he was and he was responsible for his 20 some odd siblings. And his father had three wives and they were apparently baby making machines. His father was killed by a drone strike. But it raises a larger issue. And Barbara Lee is going to be on the program with us a little bit later, talking about this. She being the only person in all of Congress who voted no in the days after 9/11 in 2001 to go into Afghanistan. Forget Iraq, Afghanistan. Afghanistan was our original horrible mistake. And, you know, because at that time, Osama bin Laden had just a couple thousand buddies in Afghanistan, and the Taliban was willing to arrest him and deport him. And that would have put an end to that. And the Taliban was perfectly willing to cooperate with international authorities to arrest him and his people. In fact, they had just taken $43 million from George W. Bush to burn the opium crops, the opium poppies all across Afghanistan in March of 2001, which they did. Dried up worldwide opium supplies, doubled the price of heroin, cut heroin addiction all around the world, particularly in Europe and Russia. It's one of the few good things George W. Bush did. I mean, Afghanistan had a GDP of $2 billion a year. He gave him $40 million. That's big money in a little town, in a little country like Afghanistan. And that money got passed along to the farmers by the Taliban in exchange for... But here's the bigger issue. When we are dealing, the president was right. He called this out, but it seems to me that he hasn't followed the logic of this. He was right when he said that ISIL and Al Qaeda and these other groups, I think he was speaking specifically of ISIS, that they're death cults. They are not Islam any more than Hitler was Christianity. Or Pol Pot was Buddhism. They're death cults. And the people following them are basically cult followers. Now, what do you do with cult followers? I have a dear friend who, in fact, I think he just recently moved to Israel. He's a psychologist, and for years and years, way back in the day, when we were both teenagers, he was into the Maharaji's cult, you know, the 13-year-old perfect master back in the 70s. And he followed him for a couple of years. And then Ted Patrick, the famous deprogrammer, came in and deprogrammed my friend. And then my friend became Ted Patrick's cohort in helping parents kidnap people from these various cults and deprogram them. And basically, when people are in cults, particularly death cults, I mean, Maharaji was not a death cult. It was more like a, hey, let's worship Maharaji cult. But when people are in cults, something has to cause them to question the absolute superiority of the cult's logic, theology, worldview, all that kind of stuff. before you can deprogram them. Before you can deprogram them, you have to demonstrate to them that the cult is wrong. So how do you do that? If you look at World War II, if you read Milton Mayer's They Thought They Were Free, or you read William Scherer's The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, what you get is that average Germans got swept up in the death cult of the Nazis. And average Japanese, if you read any histories of Japan in World War II, average Japanese got swept up in the death cult of Hirohito. The Germans thought Adolf Hitler was the, literally, I mean, I knew some of these old Germans. They were in their 70s, 80s, 90s when I got to meet them back in the 1970s and 1980s. But they had been in Hitler's army. They had been in some cases, you know, reasonably high positions, not like, you know, SS or something like that. But I mean, you know. And when the American forces came in and defeated Hitler militarily, that was the beginning of cracking the death cult in Germany. But there was still a lot of Nazis in Germany in the weeks after World War II. What broke that death cult, what totally broke it, was the publicizing throughout Germany of the liberation of Auschwitz and Dachau and Belsen and all these other death camps, was showing that it was a death cult. And people were going, whoa, I was supporting that? Same thing in Japan. Japanese believed the emperor was, you know, the sun god, the incarnation of the sun god. It was a death cult. And when we defeated them in World War II, and these were people who were willing to die. I mean, not just, hey, I'm going to go off and fight for my emperor. They were willing to dive airplanes onto the decks of U.S. carriers, the kamikaze pilots, suicide pilots. And when they realized that their emperor was not divine and that divine providence wasn't going to cause Japan to win as it had in the past, I guess in their minds, the cult fell apart. I mean, there was an existential crisis in Japan. So the question then becomes, if ISIL and Al-Qaeda and their buddies are part of a death cult, how do we dismantle that death cult? Do you do it with military force? Because that's what the president's asking for. And he even wants to put U.S. troops, or he wants the authority to, in the event that it's necessary, to put U.S. troops on the ground in Syria and in northern Iraq. Now, I would submit to you that the source, the feeding point for this death cult is twofold. Number one, it's Saudi Arabia. They have been financing Wahhabism and Salafism for generations, and they're continuing to finance it. ISIS wouldn't exist if it wasn't for Saudi Arabia. For that matter, neither would Al-Qaeda. 9/11 never would have happened if Saudi Arabia hadn't cut this deal with the Wahhabists over 100 years ago. It's number one, Saudi Arabia. And number two, our occupation of two countries in the middle of the Middle East. You know, I've said this before. What if the Canadians didn't like President Obama and they came in and evicted him from the White House, took down the government, and replaced it with a Canadian-run government? Well, the Canadians are kind of nice. Hey, they might even give us national health care. But would you be, you know, if you saw Canadian soldiers marching up and down in the street in front of your house, might you be inclined to take a shot at one of them? I mean, maybe not. Maybe you're more of a pacifist. But frankly, I don't think that any country, including the United States, and we actually went through a Canadian occupation in the War of 1812, I don't think most Americans would put up with it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So how do you break that death cult? How do you, particularly if those are the two sources of its stranglehold, I'll tell you in 4 minutes. And just a little more on this. This from the District Sentinel. And they don't put bylines on these articles, so I'm not sure if Sam Knight or Sam Sachs, I'm not sure who wrote this, but it's from districtsentinel.com. And, you know, very straightforward. In its quest to gain congressional authorization for the ongoing war against Islamic State, the White House is this week seeking explicit legislative approval to deploy U.S. ground troops in Iraq and Syria. You know, I say congratulations for asking. I mean, that's a good thing. The Constitution, it pretty explicitly says that only Congress has the power to declare war, and we're talking about an act of war here. We're talking about President Obama as commander-in-chief, leading our troops, or directing our troops in any case, during time of war. War has to be declared by Congress, so the president is basically saying, give me a declaration of war. He's not actually literally saying that, because there's not a country that you're declaring war against. This is not World War I or World War II. There's this group, and it's one of a dozen groups. I mean, there's all kinds of al-Qaeda offshoots all over the Middle East, all over the world for that matter, that he wants to declare war on. He wants to fight. Now, Barbara Lee has a different idea. And there's an interesting piece about this in the New York Times today. Barbara Lee, the only person who voted no for congressional authorization for Afghanistan, the only member of Congress who saw where this was going, who had the insight, the wisdom, the prescience to realize that if we followed George W. Bush into a war in Afghanistan, it would never end. I mean, we would be opening the gates of hell. We would be destroying a country that was already in the Stone Age, and it would not produce a good result. So here's what she's suggesting for now. She's introducing legislation. John Boehner will not bring this to the floor for a vote. Guarantee. I wish he would. And I frankly doubt that Barbara Lee has enough colleagues to come up with a discharge petition that would force it onto the floor, whether Boehner wants to stop it or not. I mean, they couldn't get a discharge petition to extend long-term unemployment insurance. Not one Republican would say, oh, yeah, unemployed people should get unemployment insurance. No, they cut that off. Right? If you're unemployed in America, Republicans, their attitude is screw you. So anyhow, Barbara Lee, the legislation that she's putting forward would rescind the authority that Obama has been using, which is the old AUMF for George W. Bush. It would say, sorry, we're just going to take that away from you. Now, you've got to figure out how to work this thing out without the military. We want a plan. We want projected costs. We want metrics. We want timelines for diplomatic, political, and economic ways to counter ISIS. Very straightforward. Under her bill, the New York Times writes, actually somebody in the New York Times writes, Julie Hirschfield Davis. Under her bill, Mr. Obama would have 90 days to send Congress a report with a detailed accounting of the military equipment the United States is sending to Syria and a description of the number of civilian casualties alleged to have resulted from American airstrikes. The resolution would also bar the Pentagon from spending any money to deploy ground troops in a combat role against ISIS. So here's the question. How do you shake people out of a death cult? Now, if you were talking to King George III in 1778, he would say, you know, those Americans are a death cult. We send our businesses over there. They destroyed our tea. They blow up our stores and our ships. We send our soldiers over there. They shoot at them. They won't even stand in formation in line like military is supposed to. They hide behind trees. They're terrorists. This is a death cult. Think about it for a minute. Yes, George III, King George III, used the word terrorist to describe George Washington and our soldiers. So what was it that animated the American death cult, to use King George III's, well, he didn't use that phrase, but you get my point. It was occupation. We were occupied by a foreign country. Now, for a long time, we thought we were that country. Prior to, in 1772, Thomas Jefferson published a tract called a something view of the rights of British Americans. And it was basically how to be a good British subject while living in North America. Thomas Jefferson. 1 year later, the Tea Act happens, world's largest tax cut for the British East India Company. The vandalism happens where they destroyed the tea in Boston Harbor, and Thomas Jefferson and everybody else were, okay, that's it, we're off to the races. We are going to fight back. What had been a benevolent occupation has become a malevolent occupation. What had been us occupying us has become them occupying us. And we shared religion, cultural history, social history, lineage. I mean, virtually all the white people anyway in North America could track, you know, they knew where their families came from in Europe. And yet still we said, no, we don't want to be occupied. So number one, stop the occupation. People say, oh, but all hell will break loose. Yeah, when we stopped occupying Vietnam, all hell broke loose for a while. And then they sorted it out. People say, well, you stopped occupying Cambodia and Pol Pot killed 2 million people. Well, we never occupied Cambodia. We just bombed them illegally, secretly, Richard Nixon. But again, it's a great example. You break a country, you have some responsibility for what happened. And we took no responsibility after Vietnam for what happened in Cambodia. And 2 million people died. So how do you break the back of a death cult? Number one, you take away their rationale for being, their excuse for their existence. The excuse for the existence, well, when the Soviet Union was occupying Afghanistan, the death cult, the freedom fighters was what Ronald Reagan called them. He invited them to the White House. This was the Mujahideen, today known as Al-Qaeda. It was Osama bin Laden and his buddies. Ronald Reagan loved them. He sent them all kinds of money. Fight those Soviets. They're occupying your country. We're on your side. We're against the occupiers. And they were like, cool, we'll take your money. We'll take your weapons. They threw out the Soviets. And some semblance of rationality. Now, you know, obviously, I don't think that the Taliban is the most... Well, actually, they're very rational. I don't think that they're all that humane. But some sense, semblance of, you know, kind of peace and stability at least came to the country. It wasn't a country that you or I would want to live in. But the Soviets just got the hell out. And then George W. Bush comes along in 2002, and we get the hell back in. So number one, stop the occupation of these various countries. You know, John Kerry a couple of days ago spoke about President Assad of Syria and stopped calling for him to leave Syria. He said, we'll work with Assad. I mean, essentially, we're changing our foreign policy. We're saying, you know, Assad, brutal dictator, all, you know, but that's fine. We're concerned about this death cult. Well, let Assad deal with the death cult in his own country. Let the Syrians say, you know, hey, I'm a Syrian, or I'm not. Why is it our fight? Now, you could build a case with Iraq and Afghanistan that it's our fight to the extent that we broke their countries. And this is how we broke the death cults after World War II in Japan and Germany. We didn't go in and exploit their countries the way that L. Paul Bremer and Wolfowitz did. And excuse me. And who was our defense secretary? Rumsfeld. Why am I constantly mixing up Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz? Anyhow, Donald Rumsfeld. We didn't use Germany and Japan to enrich our American corporations. In fact, we've got clips on one of the machines here, FDR famously saying, I do not want to see one millionaire made as a result of this war. We didn't do that. We didn't send Halliburton in. We didn't send GE in. Instead, we sent them money, and we loaned them money and said, use this money to build your own factories, to build your own steel mills, your own cement factories. Did you find the clip? Yeah. Here's FDR, I think. Here we are.
Our present emergency and a common sense of decency make it imperative that no new group of war millionaires shall come into being in this nation as a result of the struggles abroad.
There you go. I mean, no war millionaires. That's the exact opposite of what George W. Bush did. And the people in Iraq and Afghanistan know it. We send our companies over there. They build crappy buildings. People get electrocuted. Our own soldiers. People die. The buildings fall apart. It's just. So just give them the money and say, here, rebuild your country. Or help them rebuild the country with local materials and local people. Don't send in American contractors. That takes away the rationale for the death cult's existence. There's no longer an occupation. And we're helping you put your country back together. And we will provide a good example of being good neighbors. And then as the death cult continues, because there were, you know, hangers-on, there were Nazi hangers-on after World War II in Europe. There were Hirohito lovers in Japan after World War II. Then you let the local country deal with their own local death cult. It's real simple. We've been through this before.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
But if we go down this road that the president is asking for, of boots on the ground in these countries, let's occupy two more countries, it's just going to expand and extend this. The bad and the very, very aphoristically ugly. The good. John Stewart. On Monday, the Daily Show host gave his take on the whole Brian Williams lying about his time in Iraq scandal and said what needed to be said about the hypocritical reaction from the mainstream media. Check it out.
I am happy. Finally, someone is being held to account for misleading America about the Iraq war. Finally. Now, It might not necessarily be the first person you'd want held accountable on that list, but never again will Brian Williams mislead this great nation about being shot at in a war we probably wouldn't have ended up in if the media had applied this level of scrutiny to the actual war.
Right, if the media had applied this level of scrutiny to the actual bleeping war. My thoughts exactly, John. And we're going to miss you. The bad. Representative Steve King, the Iowa congressman, responded to a trumped-up controversy over President Obama's national prayer breakfast speech, as only he can, by tweeting out a picture of the president in a turban, the implication being that the president is secretly a Muslim. You know, at this point, it's hard to be surprised by anything Steve King does, but come on, man, couldn't you at least get a little more creative with your racist insults? I mean, that whole Obama is a secret Muslim thing, that is so Donald Trump in 2008. And the very, very ugly, Kimberly Taylor, principal of a New York high school for kids with special needs, is under fire this week after a colleague leaked to the press recordings of her yelling at students and calling them names. Check this out, a local news controversy, a news report about the controversy.
The worst, he says, was when the principal became unhinged after two students got into a scuffle during a graduation rehearsal. Egan says she then dragged one of the kids up to the front of the auditorium filled with students of various learning disabilities.
This is a resort! How embarrassing!
That's disgusting embarrassment. Get the hell out of my sight.
On another recording, Principal Taylor rips into a student for failing to give his seat to a teacher.
Get your ass up! Be a man!
God, for God's sake, you animals!
Wow. Wonder if that's a privatized school. Talking to anyone like that, let alone kids with special needs, is totally unacceptable and very, very ugly. That's just amazing. So anyhow, I hope that I have, in a reasonably clear fashion, stated my position on ISIS, ISIL, death cults, how you deal with them. You know, if an entire country is seized by a death cult, then taking down the government of that country sometimes is enough, but you have to actually be able to demonstrate to the people of the country that their government was a death cult. Otherwise, you're just, you know, moving one dictator for another, or one democratically elected president with a dictator. I mean, like, this is what we did in Iran, this is what we did in Iraq, it's what we did in Honduras, it's what we did in Guatemala, it's what we did in Argentina, it's what we did in Chile. We overthrew democratically elected governments and installed dictators. And in some cases, they became leaders of death cults. Like in Chile, it took some 30 years for the people of Chile to rise up and say, as I recall, maybe it was less than 30 years, but whatever it was, to rise up and say, enough already. Mr. Pinochet, get the hell out of here. We want our country back, which people will eventually do if you stop messing with them. So anyhow, your thoughts on this topic, John, in Menlo Park, California. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hi, you wanted to get in on this. Hi, Tom. I support Free Speech TV and you and Amy because you speak like nowhere else on our media speaks, and I appreciate it. I just want to comment and extend one thing you've been saying. We have to understand what the motivations behind the people that we are calling terrorists are. The Middle East never, since the Crusades, had this type of turmoil until the internal combustion engine in World War I demonstrated that oil was the most strategic material on the planet. And so the British and French and ultimately the United States has stepped in, and we drew lines all over the desert based on where we thought the oil was at that time and started disrupting people's lives who had been promised that they were going to be free.
Right. You're talking about the end of World War I and the deconstruction of the Ottoman Empire.
World War I, right. Yeah. And everything pretty much went on until after World War II. And the first thing, the first occupation, which had been growing since the British took the Mandate of Palestine, was the occupation of Palestine. And the United Nations, violating its charter in its first year, its charter, which says nothing can be done to the to a nation changing the political system or the population of that state without there first being a plebiscite.
No, I get it, John. You believe that the existence of Israel is a violation of the UN Charter and is an occupation. I got it. Do you want to take it beyond that, or is that your point?
So much of the destability of the Middle East began with that, and then it's been.
I don't disagree, John, but I'm going to move along. That is not what this is all about. Yes, the Palestinian situation and the Israeli situation must be resolved, and the Israelis, in my opinion, are behaving very badly in this regard. Not that the Palestinians have always been wonderful; they certainly haven't. And they really should have taken some lessons from Mr. Gandhi instead of from Mr. Arafat. But that said, I'm talking about a different part of the Middle East, and I'm talking about American involvement. Carl in Nashville, Tennessee, you're up.
Hey, Tom. You know, this is a very interesting conversation that you're having. And I'm going to even add to it, to the death cult. It's just weird to me how people worship other human beings. Giving an example, the British monarchy or any European monarchy or any monarchy in the Middle East, or the worship of the wolves of Wall Street and the banksters. It's like the world is in this death march along with whatever cult that they are. Are particularly worshiping at whatever given moment in our
Carl,
history.
I think that all of us, deep down inside, we may look like grown-ups, we may look like adults, we might be in our 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, whatever, but deep down inside, there's a part of us that is still a little child and still trying to get mom and dad's approval and mom and dad's love and mom and dad's protection. And that makes us vulnerable to authority figures and anybody else who kind of plays that surrogate role of mom or dad. It's astonishing to me when I am in public venues, like at the correspondence dinner, where the president was speaking, and people like Donald Trump walk into the room, right? A star in quotes, and everybody's like, you know. Or occasionally, you know, I'll do a book signing or something. Somebody treats me like a star. I don't get it. You know, well, I do get it. I mean, I understand what's going on, but I'm not sure it's all that healthy. But I think that this is part of human nature. You're not going to change that, Carl. This.
You know,
go ahead.
You know, unfortunately, the monarchs of the world understand this, and they've understood this for thousands of years. And if you just go back and just mind your history, just, you know, it's hard for us as Americans, or the Americans who do understand our history, especially what happened with the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, and with Ronald Reagan embracing the Al-Qaeda.
The Mujahideen, then, yeah.
It's like, their predecessors. It's like, we understand these things, and it is frustrating as hell to me, and I know to you, that other people don't understand this. So it's hard for us to make other people understand world history as far back as 100, 200, 300 to 1,000 years back, and understand that this is not a new phenomenon.
But we also
for us who understand these things. We got people who don't even understand history of 25, 30 years ago.
Right, and that's a huge problem, Carl. I'm with you. Carl, thank you for the call. Thanks for weighing in. Joe in Chicago Heights, you want to challenge me, Joe?
Yes, hi. Great conversation, and I just have one hopefully constructive criticism and one suggestion. And that part of the problem seems to be very exasperated, not just by the Muslim religious leaders, but by other religious leaders and political religious leaders that do advocate violence and hostility when they feel they're insulted.
Do you think, Joe, that the Presbyterian, which was the dominant Protestant religion in the United States in America in 1776, that the Presbyterian and Congregationalist ministers in their churches were not preaching that we should be shooting British soldiers?
I am saying that this is a universal problem with many religious and political leaders that advocate violence when they feel that they are treated unjustly or have been harmed.
Right.
And that,
which gets back to the treating unjustly or harmed. If we hadn't been occupied by England, we wouldn't have fought a war against them.
Right. But I'm saying, but you've got, starting with, in really in our recent news, was the Ayatollah Khomeini, advocating the death of Salman Rushdie. And you've got a lot of religious leaders that, when something is done, they advocate for people to go out and seek revenge and death.
Right.
So it is tied to religious leaders that are promoting a lot of these, horrible.
I don't disagree, Joe, but it's very important that we all understand that, yeah, there are some Muslim leaders who are saying, get the hell out of my country, and if you don't, I think that we should be killing you. On the other hand, that is true of virtually every religion in the world.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And it happens when people are occupied, whether it's Buddhists in South Vietnam, or whether it's Muslims in the Middle East, or whether it's Presbyterians in Massachusetts. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Rich in Sun City, Arizona, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Rich, what's up?
Well, Tom, my view of this whole thing here about what you're talking about, the basis of all the problems on the planet revolves around two things, inequality and injustice. If people have a life of their own and are not struggling and scraping and the people aren't being incarcerated for nothing, no reason, or you see these injustices on the street, such as Ferguson and these others, if you eliminate all this, you're not going to have problems in the world, and they're not going to be attracted.
Yeah, there's a reason why there's not an insurgency going on in Denmark right now.
Yeah.
So
quality, people struggling, can't eat, don't have food, they can't hardly live.
Yep.
You take a look at the Middle East. Monarchies all over. Well, it's inevitable.
Yeah,
that they're going to rise up against those.
Yeah. Well, and this is what people do. Nobody likes their country occupied, particularly by somebody who doesn't look like them, somebody who doesn't speak like them, someone who doesn't share a history with them, someone who has no understanding of their culture. Nobody likes their country to be occupied, but particularly by folks who fall into those categories that I just described. And that's what we're trying to do in the Middle East. We think that we can be successful if we can just occupy enough of it aggressively enough. And it never has worked in the history of the world, to the best of my knowledge. I mean, arguably, you could say that, when Polk fought the Mexican-American War and seized Southern California, Arizona, New Mexico, and part of Texas from Mexico, that we successfully occupied the southwestern United States. But at that time, there were so few people who lived there that, you know, it was of little consequence, I think, other than to the people who lived there. I mean, it was of great consequence to them, but I can't think of any other successful occupations.
Well, you know, and I'll tell you, the major problem here is we have a government that is locked in the 19th and 20th century mentality. They're not moving into the 21st century.
Yeah.
Now, Obama, he's made his mistakes, but at least he is looking into the 21st century. And if we get the correct people in Washington, if they stop reelecting the same people, as my son says, there should be nobody in Washington with white hair.
Yeah.
But that's where the change is going to have to be made.
Well, respectfully, Rich, the phrase "we elect" that you just said, that's the key to the whole thing. It's not that's who's in Washington. Yeah. It's who's voting.
I have told so many of these young people that I've met periodically, and I told them, when are you people going to get off your hands?
Right.
These people are creating a world that you're going to live in, and you're not going to like it.
Yeah.
Because it's the 19th and 20th century way of doing everything, and it doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. Yep, you're absolutely right. And this is the new, and the next hour, or maybe the hour after, I want to get into this whole Koch brothers saying that, oh, yeah, we're libertarians, we're socially liberal. Young people, you should like us. We like gay marriage. Not so much. But, yeah, good point, Rich. Thank you very much for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before the hour. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, your media support group for we the people of the United States of America and the planet. I am so pleased and honored to have back on the show with us right now Congresswoman Barbara Lee, U.S. Congresswoman from the 13th District, representing the 13th District of California. Lee.house.gov is her website. And the one person who had the common sense back in 2002, I believe it was, to see that George W. Bush's plans to occupy the Middle East forever were crazy. Am I, Congresswoman Lee, am I mischaracterizing or exaggerating here?
I'm glad to be with you. That actually is 2001. It's 3 days after me.
I'm sorry, I can't understand you. It sounds like maybe your thumb is over the microphone.
Oh, can you hear me now? Is that any better?
It's pretty bad.
Is that any, wait just a minute, let me see. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, that's a little bit better.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay. That was actually 2001, right after the...
2001, that's right, right after 9/11. Yeah.
And that was when President Bush came and presented a blank check, really, for perpetual war. It was a resolution that authorized the use of force, had no end date, had no designation in terms of what the strategy was. It just said that the president was authorized to use force against any nation, organization, individual, deemed connected to 9/11.
Right.
That was so broad. It's been used over 30 some times based on some declassified reports from the Congressional Research Service, and that really has set the stage.
It did
set the stage for Iraq. It set the stage now for what is taking place in Syria. And the resolution that I've introduced that presents a comprehensive strategy on how to deal with ISIS is a resolution that would actually repeal the 2001 resolution.
So your phone is pretty bad, and so let me just recap for people who might not have been able to understand what you said. Basically, that authorization to use force back in 2001 that George W. Bush used against Afghanistan initially has been used repeatedly since then by him and by President Obama, and in ways that it was not originally intended. It's gone crazy, and you're proposing a piece of legislation, my word, not yours, and you're proposing a piece of legislation that would require the president to submit, I'm reading here from the New York Times, to submit a detailed plan with timelines, projected costs, and metrics for success for diplomatic, political, and economic ways of countering ISIS or ISIL, as opposed to military ways. Do I have that right, Congresswoman Lee?
No, let me just say, this doesn't take any military action off the table. What we're saying is that this must be a comprehensive strategy if we're really going to dismantle and disable ISIS.
Right.
And you have to have a diplomatic initiative, because we know many of the root causes of what is taking place. And military action alone is not going to ensure the national security of the United States nor the region. And so we have to have a debate, and we have to come up with an authorization that really provides a path forward where we can make sure that there's regional peace and stability, not engage in more bombing and in more wars.
Why do you expect that so few, I mean, you've got a Republican majority in the House, and among them you've got a bunch of saber rattlers who are, you know, of the John McCain bomb variety. How do you expect this to play out when you drop this? Have you dropped this piece of legislation?
Yes, we dropped it. And you know, we never know, because the American public is war weary, first of all. The public understands that we have to do something as it relates to the real barbaric attacks against ISIS and what they're doing in the region. And so we have to come up with a way to put that to rest and to really move forward and at least ensure some stability and stop the terrible killings and not allow more wars to be created out of this. Right. And so, you know, hopefully the debate and the public will understand that if we really want to ensure our national security and deal with ISIS, then we're going to have a comprehensive strategy, and that we cannot have ground troops, we cannot engage our military personnel in another war. And that's going to just create more danger and more hostility toward our country. And so we have to have a comprehensive strategy.
Yeah, totally agree with you. Where do we take this? How can Americans speak out on behalf of your legislation? How, you know, if they call this congressional switchboard 202-225-3121 and say, I'd like to speak to my member of Congress, here's my zip code, and they connect them to their member of Congress's office, what should they say?
Sure, they should go down and they should just say, look, support the and we can get you the actual resolution number, but the Lee resolution, be sure to go on as co-sponsoring that bill. The more members of Congress who co-sponsor the bill, the more likely we are to get a debate and a vote on that. And so they don't even need to call their Washington office. They can call their district office. Know who your representative is. Go down. Meet with them. Send them email. Call. And that way, you know, we can engage the public, because it's going to be the public. And that's the constitutional requirement, that Congress engage in war, peace and war making policy.
Right.
And so the people's voice is really reached.
Why not take it a step further and ask for a specific congressional resolution of war? We haven't had a congressional resolution of war, to the best of my knowledge, since World War II. And yet the Constitution says, basically, we can't shoot anybody until Congress says so.
Well, I think Congress has skirted its responsibility. If we're going to engage in war, the Constitution requires we declare war. I mean, that's the next step, because we have been in the state of perpetual war, especially since 2001.
Right.
And this is going to continue under our watch, under any president's watch, Bush, now President Obama, and moving forward. I think this president, however, has tried to nail his military response and has tried to look at alternatives to the use of force, or in addition to the use of force. But I think what's important is that the use of force is not the first option, and that's not the only option.
Right.
The public has to weigh in on that and say, yes, if we're going to stay in war, declare war. If not, if we're going to engage in some form of military action, at least have the authorization.
Right.
The comprehensive authorization that doesn't lead to more warfare and more hostilities.
We're just about out of time. Are there any members of Congress who are proposing that we do something like the Marshall Plan, where instead of sending in our contractors so that they can profit off rebuilding another country, we loan or give the money to these countries in the Middle East and let them rebuild themselves?
Well, I think, you know, we've seen what has taken place in Iraq. We've sent trillions of dollars.
Pretty corrupt.
Iraq and Afghanistan. We need to audit the Pentagon and first see where U.S. tax dollars have gone.
There you go.
Because we still haven't been able to audit the Pentagon.
Totally with
you. I do think it's the region's responsibility.
Okay. Thank you. Congresswoman Barbara Lee, you're great. Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends. Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
After Chris Christie goes to the UK and makes a fool of himself, following a long line of Republicans like Mitt Romney, who went to the UK and made a fool of himself, guess who's in the UK right now? The bat boy for the Koch brothers, Scott Walker. Their favorite boy is over there right now, and guess what he's not going to do? He's not going to take questions from the press.
Gee.
Okay, back to my ISIS is a death cult. Al Qaeda is a death cult. Boko Haram is a death cult. What do you do with death cults? The most effective way that you can empower a death cult within a country that has not already seized control of the country. Now, there are very, very important distinctions here. If you've got a death cult that already has taken control of the country, and they are metastasizing, they're spreading out from that country into other countries. This is what Germany did in World War II, or prior to World War II. This is what Japan did, moving into China and into South Korea. Actually, it was all Korea back then, I think. And the Philippines and whatnot. This is what happened with these two countries, Germany and Japan. Their death cults metastasized. And so in order to take them down, we had to take down the countries, because the death cults were headquartered in those countries. Where is the headquarters for Salafism and Wahhabism? It's Saudi Arabia. Now, am I suggesting we take down the Saudi government? No. But we do have considerable influence over the Saudi government. And now might be a really good time for us to say, hey, can we work with you guys to become a little less rigorous in your Wahhabism and a little more secular in the way that you're dealing with people? Will you please let, for example, those two or three daughters of the previous king, King Fahd, will you let them out of jail because they just were tweeting like women should be allowed to drive? How about that blogger who's getting 50 lashes every week for the next X number of years? How about just dialing back on the amount of support you're giving Saudi Arabia to these hard right clerics and their publishing companies who are printing books that are being used in the occupied territories, that are being used in other Muslim countries that suggest, for example, that Jews take the blood of Muslim children to make matzo balls and things like that, or to make matzah. How about dialing it back? Isn't it time to have, I mean, we're ignoring the giant elephant gorilla. I mean, you pick your lousy cliche metaphor in the room, which is the effect and influence of Saudi Arabia in this region. And how they have been exporting this kind of fundamentalism that is now showing up in the form of ISIS and Boko Haram, and originally, from our point of view, showed up in 9/11 with, what, 17 Saudis? Or was it 14 out of the, 17 out of the 19, I think, whatever it was, 14. A majority said, this is, I mean, you know, sow the wind, reap the whirlwind. I think it might not even be a bad idea to say to the Saudi government, to say to the kingdom, even though you have the third largest military in the world and we have been supporting you and sending you fortunes, we're going to stop that. We're going to put a ban on importing Saudi oil, for example. Let them export all they want. If it's true that the Saudis are dropping the price of oil right now intentionally so that they can put the U.S. solar industry and the U.S. fracking industry out of business, well, putting the fracking industry out of business, you know, I'm not crying any crocodile tears, but the solar industry, the wind industry, they're taking a big hit from this because they are incredibly profitable and, you know, very desirable. They're very reasonable alternatives to oil when oil's over $80 or $90 a barrel. So Saudi Arabia is keeping it below that. Isn't it time to say to Saudi Arabia, enough, stop supporting these Salafites, stop supporting these Wahhabists. We've got a serious problem here that has metastasized beyond Saudi Arabia, beyond the rest of the Middle East. It's showing up in Paris. Je suis Charlie. It is showing up in Spain. It's showing up in the UK. It's showing up in the United States. It's starting to show up all around the world. And the core of this is this fundamentalist, violent, frankly, I think barbaric strain of Islam that has been promoted by Saudi Arabia since roughly the time of the American Civil War. They just never had the means to really push it hard until recently. Don in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Don, welcome to the program. It says here you're a Mideast scholar, or you heard one.
I'm calling about a book.
Okay.
That you might have heard of. It's called The Thistle and the Drone, and the subtitle is How America's War on Terror Became a Global War on Tribal Islam.
I think we had the author of that book 2 years ago on the TV show. Who is the author?
Ahmed is his last name.
Mm-hmm. It sounds familiar, but I can't say that I haven't read the book, Don. I'm sorry. So
okay.
So tell us the premise.
Okay. The man was an official in a remote area, and I'm not sure if it was Afghanistan or Pakistan, so he knows about these issues.
Right.
He's a professor, maybe in Washington, D.C. now, and what he's doing is he's bringing up the issue of the tribalism.
Mm-hmm.
And you've talked about the death cult. The tribes in many of these countries are in conflict with the central government. But by using drones, what America has done is disrupted the tribal system, which is going to cause all kinds of problems all over the place.
Right. Is already causing all kinds of problems all over the place. But now we're extending it to Yemen and to Pakistan and whatnot. Yeah, I'm with you. Fascinating. I just wrote that down. The thistle and the drone, right, Don?
That's correct.
Okay, I'm going to ask Sean to get on this. This sounds like he might make a great guest. Thank you for the call, Dawn in Smithville, West Virginia. Hey, Dawn, you taught world civilization?
Yeah, I taught. I'm a substitute teacher in a very small town,
mm-hmm.
and I was teaching a three-month section of world history, world civilization, and it was on Islam, basically the rise of Islam. And a lot of the kids, they were 10th graders, and these were kids that were expected to drop out. They were not expected to graduate.
Mm-hmm.
They were ADD, dyslexic, whatever.
Sure.
And a lot of them were saying, several of them were saying they were going to join the army. This was 6 years ago.
Right.
And
Dawn, I just have 45 seconds, just FYI.
Okay. I posed the same question to them. What would you do if somebody came in here and told you how to live?
Right.
And they all responded pretty much in unison. We'd shoot them.
Yeah. Yeah. I just got an email from a fellow in Canada who's listening to the show, probably on Sirius, Rick in Canada. He says, I love it when you use the example of Canadians invading the lower provinces. Don't tell anyone, but we have plans in place. Have had plans in place ever since had Sarah Palin ever taken power. I'm sure you would approve of that. We are neighbors, of course. I'll share the rest of the email with you. But Dawn, thank you. Thank you for validating my point. Even high school kids get it. You're absolutely right. Dawn, thank you. And thank you for being a teacher. Thank you for serving your community and your country with one of the most important jobs out there. I appreciate it. 15 minutes past the hour.
the Tom Hartman Program.
What's the best way to deal with the cancer of a death cult? Bombs? Diplomacy? What? Welcome back. Robin, watching Free Speech TV in Kingston, Washington. Hey, Robin, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I agree fully with your arc into the war, starting with George Walker Bush announcing before he was elected that he was going to go to war if he was elected.
Right.
I actually have a friend, Jimmy Tingle, who heard him say that in Boston. This is before Herkowitz's book. In any event, there's what, and I agree fully with Cheney taking over the energy meetings and then the whole sequence. But there was one, and I'm an ex-air traffic controller, and I'm an unabashed war activist. I'll be out on the 11th today in Silverdale, Washington with my street signs. And I haven't quit, okay? I'm still after it. It looks like we're cranking up again to go in and just say, no, it's time to stand up again. In any event, the one thing that you're missing in your entire arc, and I agree with how they used the entire 9/11 event, so I'm not arguing that point with you because I don't have to. The thing that is missing in your thought process is, what was the frame of mind of the United States public regarding going to any war for any reason on September 10th, 2001? And the answer is, this country was vehemently opposed to going to war because of the debacle pulled off by George Herbert Walker Bush and then, you know, the militarization sense. So I just
wanted also
to put
Vietnam.
That into your – what's that?
Also Vietnam. Vietnam, you know, we still have PTSD from Vietnam.
Oh, I agree. So what they had to do – and this is why, you know, I stand and see 9/11 being used as Pearl Harbor, Spanish-American War, the Maine, Lusitania, blah, blah, blah. We call them false flag attacks, as you know, because you know that term. So that's the thing that is missing in your thought process. You kind of smooth right through, but you don't understand that if we had taken the measurement of the public on September 10th, 2001, there would be absolutely no way that we would go to any war for any reason at that time.
Well, and this is why, if George W. Bush had been a statesman rather than a chicken hawk, and, you know, right after 9/11, when Barbara Lee was the sole vote against this, you know, authorization to go after Afghanistan, when the Taliban offered to arrest bin Laden and hand him over to a third country for trial, George W. Bush would have said, yes, let's do that, if he was a statesman. But he wasn't a statesman. He was a chicken hawk.
Right. Right. But you're making my point. You're actually making my point,
right?
Okay, that if you take a look at the entire arc of events and you understand that the public in the United States of America, that average citizens, needed to have something that would change their vote, change their point of view, and say, okay, yep, let's go to war. Sort of the same thing as the Pearl Harbor thing, which is pretty much considered to be known about well in advance. In fact, the FDR had put in, and I think it was an 8-point proposal to kind of provoke Japan. And you know about that, the oil. And
I do. I'm very familiar with the situation and the ongoing debate about it. I would add, Robin, to what you're saying, that if there was no Fox News and if the other networks hadn't started cheerleading for the war in Iraq, which they did, firing Keith Olbermann, or not Keith Olbermann, firing Phil Donahue, that we never would have had that war. Thank you, Robin. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And, very, very interesting collection of calls here. Let's just go through them. Bill in El Dorado Hills, California. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Tom, I disagree with you on ISIL or Daesh. I agree with you that, like, Dick Cheney should be tried in The Hague. We should never have invaded Iraq. But the problem is that, if I understand correctly, that one of the Japanese that was beheaded was actually captured in Turkey. And when I listened to the French TV on the web, They talked about the trial in Belgium, and the people say that they're the 50-year plan of capturing Europe. And I'm going, man, we got to stop it. You know, there's too much.
I don't disagree, Bill. What's the best way to stop it? Do you bomb the crap out of them, or do you go into those countries and say, wherever we can find civil society, even if it's at the tribal level, we will support it?
I think we should support the Kurds. Okay, that's
a starting point. Sure.
Okay. Second, I think we should attack them. I don't disagree with bombing them. I don't think that's the only avenue, but I think we should attack them.
How does it help when white Christian European ancestry people, and Europeans as well as Americans, start dropping bombs on somewhat darker-skinned Muslim Arabs? How does that help?
I don't know if it helps, but I think first of all, Kurds are the same as, ancestry-wise as the Arabs.
Sort of. They would disagree with that.
Okay, yeah, they would, but we're all related, basically.
Yeah.
However, yeah, we are.
Of course we are, but from the point of view of the people in the Middle East who are killing each other, that doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, but the problem is that we have to do it. I think it's a diplomatic and a military fight.
The thing that most Americans don't know is that ISIL and Al-Qaeda right now are going into communities that they occupy, and they're reestablishing schools, just for boys, but they're schools. They're reopening the stores. They're starting to pay out the old Social Security payments and welfare checks, basically, that were provided by previous governments. And they're bringing food and medicine in, and they're providing medical services. Now, this makes none of the American press, but everybody in the Middle East knows this. And what do you do if you're some guy who is, this 14-year-old kid who just got killed with a drone strike, he was out herding camels with his brothers when he was, when his dad was killed with it by a drone strike. And they're looking around going, okay, the guys who call themselves Al-Qaeda, they feed us, they provide us with medical care, and they protect us. And these white people, these white Christians from America, they drop bombs out of the sky that kill us. Whose side are you going to be on?
Well, actually, I agree with what they're doing, providing medical care. The problem is there's a lot.
We should be doing that. We should be doing that. I mean, we're doing that right now in the countries that were ravaged by this recent epidemic, this Ebola thing, and it's been quite successful. The people are loving us, and isn't this great? And they started out being very skeptical of us, but we came in and we said, we're here to help. I really think that there's a possibility there. Bill, I got to move along. Thank you for the call. Back to Rick's email. I'll share this really with you real quickly, and then we'll pick up the rest of the calls. He says, Tom, I love it when you use the example of Canadians invading the lower provinces. This is Rick from Canada. He says, don't tell anyone, but we did have plans in place had Sarah Palin ever taken power. I'm sure you would have to approve of that. We are neighbors, of course. Now we're taking it slower. We'll just start with the senator from Calgary. Of course, President Cruz will be taking over for Canada and Cuba at the same time. See, Ted Cruz's dad is Cuban and his mom is Canadian. Anyway, he says the only problem might be anti-Dreamer legislation, in which case we in Canada don't want him back. Also, please keep Bieber and thickies laying around. And any thickies? I'm not sure what that is. Pop culture is not my thing. There was a movie a while back, he says, where I think the U.S. annexes Canada, but this allows a Canadian to run the United States and run for presidency. In real life, we will be trying to get rid of our own little neocon Harper this year. He's already started with the Fair Elections Act, learning voter suppression from the Republicans, although we don't have your gerrymandering to the same extent. Wish us luck. Good luck, Rick. John in Fairview, Oregon. Hey, John. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Tom, you're talking about death cults and such, and connecting it back to the Nazis. Well, before there was the Mujahideen or Al-Qaeda, there was operations like Gladio and the Strategy of Tension, where asymmetrical warfare was pioneered on, you know, unsuspecting populace or whatnot. So I think the connection is a little bit more profound than maybe articulated, but basically, if you see the meetings of the ISIL on videos and such not, you'll see they do the fascist salute. Mm-hmm. And there's really no historical precedent for this in Islam.
Well, the fascist salute predates Germany. It was the old Roman salute. I mean, it's 2,000 years old. And the Romans occupied that region once, too.
Well, I didn't know that. But
yeah, this is how the salute was made to the emperor, was you hit your chest with your fist and then you throw your arm up in the air like the Nazis did. I mean, you know, this is not a Nazi salute. It's a Roman salute. It's 2,000 years old. And it probably goes back before that.
Well, perhaps you're right about that. But as far as its use, and I like the term Islamic fascism, some people don't. But as far as its use in the modern era, it doesn't come till after World War II. And we do see a lot of networking with the post-Nazi diaspora and some of the I guess you might call them radical elements.
Where?
Or in the Middle East and, well, in places like Egypt.
I think the Nazi diaspora is mostly dead, although they did have a considerable influence in South America. But John, I'd need to see some links on that one. Thank you for the call. You can post them over at TomHartman.com on our daily blog. I'll read it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be back with more thoughts on how do we deal with death cults. Is the president's request for 3 years boots on the ground in Syria, does that make sense? 28 minutes before the hours. Yes, it's our geeky science. So it's actually our geeky pigeon alert for the day. Why do they just dance around this? Why don't they just come out and say it, right? Why can't the press just tell the story the way it is? Here, this is from the Huffington Post, Carolyn Gregoire. The headline, Little Kids Learn the Same Way Pigeons Do. I think what they mean is the other way around. Pigeons learn the same way little kids do. She writes, we often point to language as evidence of our species' superiority, but the way humans learn language may not be so foreign to other animals after all. New study has found that the lowly pigeon may provide insight into how young children acquire language. Pigeons are able to categorize and name dozens of objects, which means they engage in a type of associative learning that children use to learn new words. Guess what? So do computers and robots. Anyhow, they go on to say, our view of human language as altogether unique may need revision. What we learn from studying a model animal like a pigeon may not only point to important interspecies parallels, but also help us find ways for more effectively teaching language. Animals may be more intelligent than we often consider them to be, with learning mechanisms similar to those employed by humans. Of course, especially pigeons, because they're not animals, they're robots. I mean, you study intelligent robots, and what do you get? Robot intelligence. Ever seen a dead pigeon? Ever seen a baby pigeon? No. They're robots from the planet Xeno sent here to spy on us. Come on. Get with the program. John in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Hello, Tom.
Hey, John.
I just had something to say about you talking about ISIS providing food and health and health care and everything for the citizens.
Yes.
Where did you get that at?
Oh, I've read that in dozens of different places. Most recently, there's a piece in The Guardian today about it. But it's, well, I mean, this is the law. Despotic regimes have always done this, as have non-despotic regimes. You conquer a territory if you want the people not to rise up against you. And this is the mistake that Rumsfeld made, you know, when we invaded Iraq and we took down the government. Had we then immediately said, okay, you know, the government is 50% of the economy in Iraq at the time that we took them down. Had we said, we will make sure that 50% of the economy doesn't go away, that you're not going to become unemployed, you're not going to be fired, we will continue unemployment insurance, we will continue food subsidies, we will continue Social Security payments for old age people, because Iraq had all those things. Had we done that, Iraq would not have been, you know, Iraqis would not have been shooting at American soldiers. 5,000 of our soldiers would not be dead. We wouldn't be $2-3 trillion in debt had we simply done that simple thing. But Don Rumsfeld and L. Paul Bremer and George W. Bush, they thought Iraq was going to be their libertarian experiment. And in fact, you know, Bremer has talked about this in interviews. They were going to take down the government and replace it with nothing on the assumption that the free market would come in and fill that vacuum. Well, guess what came in and filled that vacuum? You had hungry people, you had sick people, you had homeless people. Al-Qaeda came in to fill that vacuum. And, you know, these guys are not idiots, Al-Qaeda. They're well-funded. They got a lot of Saudi money, not to mention other money. Now they're controlling oil fields and things. ISIS, too. Well-funded. You know, John McCain and Lindsey Graham called up Saudi Arabia, talked to Prince Bandar, said, please, you know, get a whole bunch of money from Saudi billionaires to support Sunni insurrectionists against Assad in Syria. They did, and that's how ISIS got created. And they take over towns, and they turn the water back on. They turn the sewage back on. They fix the electrical grid. This is, I mean, there's no lack of documentation for this, John.
So you're saying that they do it just to keep the citizens turning on them?
Of course. And we should have done the same thing. It's what we did in Germany after World War II. It's what we did in Japan after World War II. It's what,
Japan.
Pardon?
I understand they did it to Japan, which I didn't agree with America going over and rebuilding Japan after bombing it.
Well, see, that's the thing. My dad was there. We didn't rebuild Japan. We provided the funding for Japan to rebuild itself. And Japan actually got little of the Marshall Plan. But they rebuilt themselves with some help from us, and they paid back the money that we had loaned them. That's a very different thing than saying we're going to occupy your country and we're not going to feed you. We're not going to house you. We're not going to rebuild your infrastructure. And when we do, it's going to be our companies coming into your country and making a profit on it. We're going to bring Halliburton into Japan. We didn't do any of that stupid stuff after World War II. We provided them with the resources to rebuild their own steel industry, their own cement industry, their own car industry, their own consumer products industries. We provided Europe and Southeast Asia with Southern Asia those resources, and you know, they're not shooting at our soldiers anymore. Had we done that in Iraq, we would have no problem, even though we took down Saddam Hussein, in my opinion. Had we simply done that, but no, these guys had to prove that libertarianism, which has never been successful in any country in the world, that if you take down the government, the free market will jump in and make everything wonderful. And I'm sorry, it has never succeeded anywhere. And when you take down a government and you've got people in pain, when demagogues like ISIS or Al-Qaeda come along and say, hey, you know, all you have to do is, you know, pray with us on Fridays and we will feed you. We will maintain your social security checks to your elderly people. We will repair your houses. We will get the water systems working and the septic systems working and the electric systems working again. People go, fine, I'm with you. And by the way, this isn't just limited to crazy people like this. This is ward politics. This is how the old machine politics used to work in Philadelphia, in Pittsburgh, in New York City. This, I mean, Tammany Hall, Franklin Roosevelt was part of this corrupt machine when he was the governor of New York State. They would go into communities, very poor communities in New York State, particularly around Manhattan, and they'd say, hey, you know, poor community you got here. How'd you like to have, you know, a subway stop? How'd you like to have running water? A lot of these communities didn't have that in the 1920s. How'd you like to have septic? How'd you like to have electricity bringing light to your home instead of these gas lanterns that keep blowing up buildings? People said, cool, do it. And they said, just vote for the Tammany Hall politicians and they'll make it happen. This is human nature, John.
Okay. Tom, before I have to go, I'm going to ask you one question on your side of it. What do you think of personal responsibility on insurance instead of ACA or Obamacare?
I'm not sure what you mean, because if you buy insurance through Obamacare, you are buying private insurance from a for-profit corporation in most cases.
Yeah, but do you believe that a person should have to provide his own insurance?
If he has the means to, yeah, which is what Obamacare says. If your income's over $60,000 a year, you buy your own insurance. If it's under $60,000 a year, we help you out.
Well, not here in Tennessee. I'm on disability, and my wife hadn't got no insurance, and I can't afford it. I don't get no help to get her insurance, which is average $350 for the programs I can find for her.
Hasn't Tennessee expanded Medicaid?
Not yet.
Not yet. Okay. See, if the Republicans in Tennessee would simply expand Medicaid, your wife would have free health insurance, and you probably would qualify for it too. I would strongly suggest, John, that you go to what's the website for Obamacare? It's healthcare.gov. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, healthcare. Go to healthcare.gov and look it up, because you may very likely, and I think the window's closing fairly soon, very likely that you and your wife both qualify for things that you may not know about, so check it out. John, thank you very much for the call. Donald in Chicago. Hey, Donald, it says here you disagree with me about Saudi Arabia.
Well, not so much disagree with you. What I'm really upset with, too, is the fact that this country, that's what gets us in the wars, because we're so worried about women over there not being able to go on the web and people that are being mistreated.
We're not, Donald. We haven't done anything to help the women of Saudi Arabia.
No, but you mentioned, said that why not, we haven't done anything to help, but you were saying that why don't we call them out and say, how come you're not doing this for the women, that are in Saudi Arabia? How come you're not giving them their rights to do certain things? What I'm trying to get at is we try to tell all these other countries what to do, and they turn their back on us, and I'm talking about our politicians. They find it so easy to change all the other countries, that yet our rights are being suppressed when it comes to voting for certain groups. Our voices are being stolen by Citizens United. They never seem to address any of those issues
right.
at all.
I agree with you on the latter, Donald. On the former, I think the point that you're missing in my argument, I was not suggesting that we should simply say to Saudi Arabia, please get a little more modern and a little less fundamentalist. And, you could start by, for example, letting women drive in your kingdom. What I was saying was we give things to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is one of the largest purchasers of military hardware from the United States. They have the third largest military in the world. We give a lot of money to Saudi Arabia for oil. We've got Saudi partnerships with our various oil companies. We support Saudi Arabia in 100 different ways, including at the United Nations. And if we said to them, our support for you from this point forward is going to be contingent on you adopting some of not just our values, but the UN Statement of Human Rights, the world's values, then we're with you. But if you're not going to do that, stand alone. Good luck. We're not going to mess with you. We're not going to drop bombs on you. But we're not going to give you any more money. That's what I was saying.
Well, okay, I see what you're saying. In other words, it's kind of like forcing them in a way to live by our rules, or we're going to stop.
Well, if you're going to take our money, if you're going to use our credibility, if you expect us to support you in the UN over and over and over again, if you expect us to turn a blind eye to slavery in Saudi Arabia, and it's there, if you expect us to turn a blind eye to the barbarism that happens in Saudi Arabia, then at least start becoming a little more modern and a little less brutal and 18th century or 16th century. I mean, Saudi Arabia is, and most importantly, stop exporting this stuff to the rest of the world. That's my big issue. The Saudis are publishing textbooks saying that Jews use the blood of Muslims to make the bread that they use for their holy holidays, for the matzah. For example, among a whole bunch of other things, this is stuff that we have been supporting for the last 60 years. We need to stop.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's time for Americans to wake up and just give a little bit of thought. No more of these Fox News bumper stickers. A little bit of thought to what actually works. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Bob in Skokie, Illinois. Hey, Bob, it says you want to disagree with me. What's up? Bob watching Free Speech TV in Skokie? No Bob. Okay, let's try Norma watching Free Speech TV in Montgomery, Alabama. Hey, Norma.
Hi, Tom. You're right again.
Oh, yeah? What did I do this time?
Well, what you said about Saudi Arabia is correct. And I was doing some little research on my own, and I was pulling up the Roman Empire, the Ottoman Empire, and an empire called the Seljuk Empire, S-E-L-J-U-K. And I personally believe that Saudi wants to extend their influence as far. You can also pull up a map of Muslims in the world and see what percentage of each country is now Muslim. And I think that the Saudis use these groups to expand their influence. And you're right, we need to stop giving them money. We built the hospital. We equipped it. We still supply it. We train and pay the people who work in the hospital, and they still lock women up. They still beat them. They still throw them in the street, yell, I divorce you, and they're homeless because the men own the children. And I think that we need sanctions on Saudi Arabia until they stop funding and supporting all of these groups that are creating terror around the world. And we can start with sanctions on what they own here in the United States and put a stop to them trying to take over our country, too. And most people don't see this.
But let's acknowledge also, Norma, it's not just Saudi Arabia. I want Saudi Arabia to stop exporting their Wahhabism as a good neighbor thing, as a starting point. And then secondly, I would love to see some changes within that country. But, you know, it's their country. They can run it pretty much any way they want, as long as they don't want our money.
Well, I think that we should stop giving them money and stop giving them aid and put some sanctions on them until they put a stop to their terrorist acts, because I personally believe Saudi Arabia is behind all of this.
Yeah, if not behind it, at least the fountain from which it is flowing. I'm with you.
Yes, I think they have an empire mentality, and I don't want to be part of their empire here in the United States.
Okay. I'm not sure about the empire thing, but the whole Salafism thing, the whole Wahhabism thing, yes. Norma, thank you for the call. Dominic in Severn, Maryland. We have a minute, Dominic. A quick one?
Well, it isn't a quick one, but the Saudi government is extremely complicated. When you say Saudi Arabia, what that people tend to think is the royal family, and the royal family is basically the equivalent of the executive branch, and the other family has control over all religious matters, and they actually have more power within the country than the Saudi royal family.
Which family is this?
There's several names, but they're the one that the agreement was made with.
So you're talking about the heirs of Mr. Wahhab?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not sure they're entirely that, but anything you read, you get.
Yeah, the Saudis were like the Bedouin tribe back in the 1840s that cut the deal with the Wahhabists, and you're right. It is more complex than a bumper sticker. Dominic, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. Before the hour, let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat.com and free-don.org over at goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Just in time for what is it, Valentine's Day?
Yes, actually, today's probably the last day that you can buy one of these lovely Swarovski crystals hearts made by women who've seen somebody killed in front of them in South Sudan and still get it for Valentine's Day. So you can go to goatsfortheoldgoat.com and order it. It's right on front of our website. So there you have it. And as long as we're talking about freedon.com, it is freedon.com, or is it org?
Org.
It's really interesting what's going on with the gay marriage and that crazy judge. I'd give about $1 million to hear what Governor Siegelman would have to say about that.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay, some other news today. So I guess the big news, well, there's two big pieces of news. Speaker Boehner said the Democrats should get off their derrieres. I don't know that I'm allowed to say the exact word he said on air, and pass the Homeland Security legislation. He is saying that the Senate Democrats, when are they going to get off their derrieres and do something other than vote no? And he said the White House passed bill would provide funding and block the president's executive orders. Well, of course, the White House also talked about that today and basically said, hey, look, they need to pass something. This is clearly important for America in terms of Homeland Security. And sorry, I'm just getting my notes on the White House here. And they said they should not be playing politics and holding up. This is what Josh Ernst said today, funding and protests with their political difference with the president. They said this is a matter the president cannot solve for the Republican leadership. So you have the speaker saying that Senate Democrats should get off their derrieres, but he used a much more direct piece of language for that. And then you have the department, you have the White House also saying that. That's kind of interesting on that today.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Now, the most of the briefing today was spent on the War Powers Authorization and what the president is actually requesting and asking about that. The Josh Earnest said that it would require Republicans and Democrats to work together for the first time, that Congress did envision a role for Congress to play a role in national security, and he also said the president does not believe in a long-term, large-scale commitment is in the United States' interests. This also related to Afghanistan, since the president has announced a clear strategy in Afghanistan, has ordered a staged withdrawal, and they said that the language of this authorization of military force was specifically kept pretty not narrow focused but broad focused, so that the president would have some ability to act. Now,
right,
many Democrats went out on, you know, sent out emails, all that kind of stuff, supporting that. There is some people that feel like this is too military.
Well, we had Ellen, we had Barbara Lee on the program in the last hour, and she has House Joint Resolution 30, which requires the president to provide specific metrics about what we're doing, not just militarily, but with regard to diplomacy, with regard to foreign aid, with regard, you know, with several other areas. Any word on how House Joint Resolution
30? Well, it was very interesting because April Ryan specifically asked when the Black Caucus met with the president yesterday whether this came up, and they just basically said, well, we're not going to provide a readout of that meeting, et cetera, et cetera. So,
wow.
You know, it's dancing. It's dancing. Speaking of doing a little bit of dancing, Yemen came up. And as you know, we cleared out of our embassy in Yemen. They, however, have said, the White House said, that the U.S. Defense Department ground personnel has been continuing operations to combat terrorism in Yemen. There were some questions about what was allowed to be taken when they left the country, when our embassy personnel left the country. And so this is kind of a mess, although it looks like other countries have stepped up and have provided safe haven for our employees of the embassy. It looks like we are running the embassy out of the country.
Right. Amazing.
Also, the speaking, going back to the authorization of military force, they said that the president is more limited this than under the 2001 authorization of military force, which allowed, of course, President Bush to go in to Iraq, which he did. The other issue is the Ukraine meeting today, and the Minsk meeting is later today. The White House says that they've provided more than $100 million in defensive equipment, things like demining equipment. Wouldn't say if they presented any offensive equipment. On a few other fronts, this is really pretty interesting. MoveOn.org released a poll on Elizabeth Warren in Iowa. And they said that 79% of the Democratic respondents said they'd like her to run for president. So far, she has a 31-24% favorable rating over Hillary Clinton. Very interesting.
Whoa.
I don't think she's going to run, but...
Yeah, and it's a long way out.
It's a very long way out. Also, the White House is going to tout the progress on Ebola this afternoon. The president's going to be speaking about that. They said that they have gotten from over 1,000 newly suspected, probable, and confirmed cases a week in October to roughly 150 cases. So they say that Ebola has gone down and that the United States has taken a role in facilitating treatment units and also, of course, sanitation and all that kind of stuff that would prevent Ebola. President is touting that as something that they're pretty proud of.
Yeah, this is a reasonably appropriate use of our military.
Exactly. Well, you and I don't disagree about that. There was scant coverage on the murder of the three Muslims in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. The White House does not have a statement at this time on that.
We don't know if this was a hate crime or if this was just a crazy person.
No, we don't know that. Okay. I mean, it could be a hate crime by a crazy person.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go.
And now also our very own Senator Sanders, and you know he's the ranking member now of the Senate Budget Committee.
Mm-hmm.
He came out, and I'm sure you've probably been talking about this, to reallocate funds for Social Security disability. And he said that if they don't do this, it is really going to harm people who are disabled. The average disability insurance benefit is less than $1,200 a month.
And people live on that. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Your Swarovski crystal heart is waiting. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Apropos of the point that I've been making here for the last hour and a half, 2 hours, this is from written by Kevin Sullivan and Carla Adam in December of last year, as in, you know, 6-8 weeks ago, December 24th, 2014, in the Washington Post. And the headline in the Washington Post, this December 24th piece, 2014, by Kevin Sullivan and Carla Adam. The headline is, hoping to create a new society, the Islamic State recruits entire families. And they're talking about, you know, last month in Syria, Siddhartha Dar stood in front of a banged up yellow pickup truck holding an assault rifle in his right hand and cradling his newborn son in his left. He proudly tweeted it out as proof that he and his wife, Aisha, and their four children had fled Britain and are now living in what is called the Islamic State. The article goes on to say, to create the Islamic society it envisions, the group, this is ISIS, has gone to great lengths to take over existing schools, hospitals, and playgrounds, or to build, as in build from scratch, construct schools, hospitals, playgrounds, these and other institutions of daily family life. Now, while we're busy dropping bombs on people and droning them from the sky, this is what ISIS is doing. Mia Bloom is a professor of security studies at the University of Mass at Lowell, and she's written extensively about women and terrorism, according to this article in the Washington Post. She was quoted, she said, when the reporters contacted her, she said, the more they, ISIS, are successful at creating a whole new society, the more they are able to attract entire families. It's almost like the American dream, but the Islamic State's version of it. Now, what was the American dream? You can have a middle class life. You can raise your kids. They can go to school. You can have access to health care. You can have a decent retirement. You can have a decent income. So, as the story continues, in the Syrian city of Raqqa, now occupied by ISIL, the group's main stronghold, in fact, the extremists have established a clinic for pregnant women run by a female gynecologist trained in Britain. Boys attend school until they're 14, at which point they join the military. Girls stay in school until they're 18. Bloom said the Islamic State also appeals to women by providing electricity, food, and a salary of up to $1,100 a month, a huge sum in Syria. This is a country where the average annual income is only a couple thousand dollars a year. This would be the equivalent of somebody offering a $50,000, $60,000 a year salary here in the United States to women to be housewives. Bloom said the Islamic State also appeals to women by providing electricity, food, and a salary of up to $1,100 a month, a huge sum in Syria for each fighter's family. The largesse is funded with money looted from banks, oil smuggling, kidnappings for ransom, and the extortion of truckers and others who cross Islamic State territory. So they have a functioning economy, they have an income source, and they're using that income to build a social safety net and the social infrastructure of a modern society. Except it's just not our version of a modern society, it's their version of a modern society, where everybody learns their version of Sharia and Islam. Bloom went on to say, this is the Mia Bloom, the professor of security studies at UMass, who is an expert on this stuff. She said, the other jihadi groups promise you all these wonderful things in the afterlife. The Islamic State promises to give you stuff in the current life and the afterlife, so you don't have to wait to enjoy all your rewards. Right. Meanwhile, The Guardian is reporting, and if you haven't seen this, there's a video that goes along with this, and we should have probably cut up some small pieces of it, but I think we just didn't have time this morning. And you can't play the whole thing. It's copyrighted. But The Guardian has a video of this 13-year-old Yemeni boy, 13-year-old boy from Yemen, whose father and brother were killed by a U.S. drone strike. And he's driving around going, yeah, they killed my father and brother. But I'm not ISIS. I'm not Al-Qaeda. Shivala Madlina Hannah Patchett and Adel Samsha in Sana'a are writing this story. This is, you know, Dateline Syria. A 13-year-old boy killed in Yemen last month by a CIA drone strike had told The Guardian just months earlier that he lived in constant fear of the death machines in the sky that had already killed his father and his brother. Mohammed Tuiman, speaking from Al-Zur village in Marib province, where he died 2 weeks ago, by the way, said, I see them every day and we are scared of them. He's talking about the drones. He said a lot of the kids in this area wake up from sleeping because of nightmares from the drones, and some now have mental problems. They turned our area into hell and continuous horror day and night. We even dream of them in our sleep. Back in 2011, 3.5 years ago, an unmanned combat drone killed his father and teenage brother while they were herding the family's camels. The drone that would kill Mohammed struck on 26 January in Harib, about an hour from his home. The drone hit the car carrying the teenager, his brother-in-law Abdullah Khalid, and a third man. Mohammed's older brother, Mokhded, came to the car to see the car where his 13-year-old brother had died in this drone strike from just a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago. And he says, I saw all the bodies completely burned like charcoal. When we arrived, we couldn't do anything. We couldn't move the bodies, so we just buried them near the car. Several anonymous U.S. government officials told Reuters that the strike had been carried out by the CIA and had, quote, killed three men believed to be Al-Qaeda militants. Right. You got to see the video of this 13-year-old kid. This is not how you win a war. I mean, you do it one of two ways. You either go in with aid and support, as we have done in many countries around the world. This is, you know, when Nasser was taking Egypt in the direction of the Soviet Union, what did Eisenhower do? Said, you know, hey, you know, we'll give you money and support. We'll help you out more than the Soviets will. Okay, cool. Egypt's been our ally basically ever since. Yeah, there was a little war in the middle there, and, you know, Eisenhower kind of pulled rank and a bit of a dispute with Israel, and that's a whole other, you know, subtext of the thing. But basically, you know, we support our allies. What about supporting the people who are under the thumbs of our enemies? I mean, we were very popular in Iraq in the 1980s. Ronald Reagan was shoveling money to Saddam Hussein. We were giving him chemical weapons to use against the Iranians. But they had, you know, a functioning society. It was, you know, Baghdad was the Paris of the Middle East. And then George Herbert Walker Bush starts his little war with them so he can get himself reelected. Didn't work out quite so well. And then Bill Clinton continues with sanctions, which killed a half a million children because they couldn't get chlorine for their water treatment plants because, you know, you can use chlorine to make chlorine gas, which is, well, it is chlorine gas, which is one of those poisons they used in World War I. Right. So instead, a half a million children died of waterborne illnesses. You think after that those families were happy with the United States? Isn't it time for us to recalibrate our foreign policy? To start making some sense? To start being the good guys of the world instead of the bombers of the world? Isn't it time to take some positive steps and to call out our so-called allies like Saudi Arabia and say, hey, stop behaving badly in the region?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And all of that, frankly, should be done before we give another 3 years authorization or a three-year authorization to the president to put soldiers on the ground in Syria. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And amazing. Absolutely amazing. Glenn in Kettle Falls, yeah. Washington. Hey, Glenn. Well, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. How are you doing today?
Good. What's up?
Well, you know, we do everything backwards. I mean, what, 15, 20 years ago, Charlie Wilson went in there and, you know, and little pieces at a time started with handgun, you know, small ammunition, small rifles, and ended up getting the Stinger missiles and taking those things down. And it really was the start of the fall of the USSR.
Yeah, that was 30 years ago. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Charlie Wilson's War is, you know, an imperfect
absolutely.
But great movie about it. Yeah.
And he begged Congress to build schools.
Yep.
And he begged Congress to build hospitals.
And he pointed out that it would be about 10% of what we had paid for the war effort.
Exactly. And here we are now doing the same thing the Russians did, getting our asses kicked.
Yep. Yep. Yeah, we should have listened to Charlie. We should have done it the right way. But you know, there's not so much money to be made doing those kind of things. A whole lot more money being made in building and building bombs and dropping them on people. Glenn, thank you. It's thank you for the history moment there. Edmund, hey Edmund, what's up?
Hi Tom. I have to tell you, it's the first time that I have to disagree with you. I admire your diversity and wealth of your knowledge in every field, but when it comes to spending money in Saudi Arabia, U.S. taxpayers don't spend a dime in Saudi Arabia. Actually, well, I have to correct myself. The money that we spend is cost of our State Department and embassy that we spend on behalf of oil corporations and defense industry, because
right.
we make sure that they make a lot of money. So Saudi Arabia is a number one client of U.S. arm industry, and Bush 41 and 43 made sure that we basically keep that dynasty and the family.
No, I agree with you, Edmund. But the other way that we're subsidizing Saudi Arabia is we pay, you and I, the taxpayers, we pay for our Navy to regulate and control and keep safe the shipping lanes from Saudi Arabia to the refineries in the United States. We pay for that. Saudi Arabia doesn't pay for
it. I 100% agree with you.
And if we were to say we're not going to provide that subsidy anymore, they would be in deep trouble.
Well, that subsidy is not, you can't allocate all of that to Saudi Arabia. We do that for basically all Kuwait, Bahrain.
Yeah, no, you're right. You're right.
You know, so, but don't forget, the Saudi Arabia was a major financial contributor along with Kuwait and
UAE.
United Arab Emirates to both Gulf Wars.
Yep. Yep. Which didn't work out so well.
No, no. I agree with Wahhabism and everything. I lived there for 7 years in Saudi Arabia. You couldn't even take a Bible or cross with you. They would dump in trash can, and U.S. Embassy wouldn't do anything about it. And they basically encouraged and support what the Saudis were doing. There were 42,000 Americans, and I had a lot of American friends. I didn't work for State Department or or armed forces. But I had a lot of friends that I was mingling with. That they were colonels and high ranking officials.
Edmund, we're out of time, but thank you for your voice. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. 20 minutes past the hour. And Diana in Poinette, Wisconsin. Hey, Diana, what's up?
Hi, I'm calling about the gentleman that called a little while ago from Tennessee, concerned about health insurance coverage, and you told him to go onto the website.
Right.
Well, this is just a heads up. A lot of the states that are not taking the exchange, like mine,
like Wisconsin,
somehow they're getting into the website to do something that discourages people. That's why a lot of people get calls and say, no, this doesn't work, that doesn't work. Well, it depends on what state you're going into it from. So I'm suggesting that he call the toll-free number. They're wonderful. They're absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, these navigators, the people who answer the toll-free number. Yeah. And is that toll-free number up there at healthcare.gov? I'm assuming it is.
I don't know. I don't trust anything on the computer anymore, but I do have the number if you want it.
Okay, go for it, Diana.
It's 800-318-2596.
Okay, 800-318-2596, right?
Yeah, it's a shame that they go to that extent, but and that's why a lot of people are calling in and saying, maybe not to you, but other, I listen to the radio a lot,
right?
And they'll say, no, it doesn't work. Well, you know, don't go on the website.
Right. Call and talk to a human being. Diana, thank you for the advice. Thank you for the information. I appreciate it. It's very, very considerate of you. And thanks for listening to the mic at 92.1 FM there in Madison. Robert in Pratt, Kansas, listening on Sirius. Hey, Robert, it says you want to disagree with me.
Yes, sir. Thank you for the call. Basically, you know, I have a couple quick points. And, you know, I agree with what you're saying about Saudi Arabia, but I disagree with the U.S. military presence as far as not just bombing people and destroying things. The U.S. government went to great lengths to supply medical care, food, facilities, schools, wells, clean drinking water, bottled drinking water, and they went to great lengths for coin to do the very thing that you're talking about. My discrepancy with you is to say that, you know, this is the same as trying to rebuild Japan is just not accurate. Japan, especially in Afghanistan's case, where there's about a 17 to 21% literacy rate, just, you know, according to what you read, they simply do not have the tools to rebuild themselves. I mean, they can't be contractors because they don't have the experience. You know, Halliburton came in with KBR. When President Obama took over in 2008, he replaced him with Fluor. Fluor was very expensive. They had a policy of 75% contractors in the region. It actually made their profits go up, and it actually made production go down because a lot of times they had to hire people that weren't qualified for the work that they put them into.
Right, but these countries had internal industry, Robert. You know, half of the Iraqi economy, it was owned by the Ba'athist Party, but they had steel mills, they had cement. Now, Afghanistan had some of that, not as much. They imported most of that stuff from outside the country. But there, you know, even if you've got a 17% literacy rate, that's where you start. That was probably the literacy rate of the United States in 1900.
Well, I have a pretty good deal of experience in both regions.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one example I can use is once we went to establishing them as their own contractors, we sent over $25 million worth of heavy equipment. And no one could use it. Basically Caterpillar and different types of equipment to build roads and those kinds of things with, you know, sat idle for almost 2 years because no one could operate them. They weren't familiar with.
Right. So why send them that fancy equipment? If they're used to building buildings with handmade brick, why not help them build brick ovens? It's not going to be as profitable for the defense contractors, but, you know, if this is their construction material, why not help them?
Well, I agree on that point.
Why do we have to take a caterpillar over there?
I agree with that point, but if you're going to rebuild the country in any kind of time constraints, you know, it has to be done or put together a little bit more than, you know, some of the local.
Oh, these people are really good at building stuff quick and dirty. I mean, it's I haven't been in Iraq and Afghanistan, but I've been in other parts of the Middle East where people basically just build stuff out of dirt, and it lasts a relatively long period of time, and it's you know, barring an earthquake like happened in Iran, you know, a couple of years ago, you know, it's okay. It's a start. And it also puts people to work. I mean, if you want people to stop being terrorists, give them a job.
I guess my final point would be, you know, I agree with those points, but I also agree that to just say that, you know, we didn't do anything, I think is not given good credit.
No, it's not that we didn't do anything. It's that we did it we did it wrong. Again, if one Caterpillar tractor that was run by really competent people, which don't exist by and large in Afghanistan, could do the work of 50 people, then the flip side of that is that by bringing in one Caterpillar tractor, you're unemploying, you're throwing 50 Afghans into unemployment. So, you know, let it be inefficient. Let 50 people make bricks in a local brick kiln and build their buildings by hand. Let it be inefficient. It's going to provide a lot of employment for a lot of people. This is a country with a GDP of only $2 billion a year. We are spending... We're spending tens of billions of dollars. Well, we're spending around $10 billion a month right now in this country. And it would be so easy for us to be supporting a local infrastructure at the level of the local competence rather than trying to say, oh, yeah, here, you know, you've got to learn how to run our jets, or you've got to learn how to run our Caterpillars, or you've got to learn how to, you know, do our kind of electrical engineering. They can do their own.
And by and large, we did. But the problem was, there was large amounts of fraud, waste, and abuse.
That's because it was our contractors going over there and doing it. They're perfectly capable of creating their own contractors.
These were Afghani contractors. If they didn't pass the code, or if there was something wrong, they would simply just pull the company name and come back in business as a different name.
Right, or bribe somebody. No, I get it. It's a very difficult part of the world, and it's a very complex situation. But my main point is that building things works better over the long term than bombing things. And anyhow, Robert, thank you for the call and for an informed call. I appreciate it. And thanks for listening to Sirius there in Pratt, Kansas. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Hey, Valentine's Day is coming up, and I have two new books out in paperback, Death in the Pines and Crash of 2016. Hey, a quick heads up for our friends in Washington, D.C. Tonight, today is Wednesday, right? Yeah. Wednesday, February 11th. So it's tonight at 6:30 at the Angelica Pop-Up Theater. Karshiar Darvich, who was on our show last week, is going to be here doing a Q&A after a special screening of Dalai Lama Awakening, the video about the Dalai Lama that I'm fairly prominently featured in. And this is an intimate 50-seat theater. It'll probably be the last Washington, D.C. screening of the film. A lot of these have been sold out, so you might want to check right away for if you're in D.C. and you're thinking of going. DalaiLamaFilm.com is the website that will get you there. So check it out. I love the movie. It's about the Dalai Lama, who is like one of my heroes, and it's about the week that I spent with him, along with about 40 other people. And which was just a remarkable and transformational week for all of us. And it's really worth seeing. Juan in Dallas, Texas. Hey, Juan, what's on your mind? Thank you for calling. Juan, watching us on Free Speech TV in Dallas, you are on the air. Okay, I think Juan either has his phone muted or he's listening to his TV. Stanley in Tyler, Texas, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Stanley.
Good day. How you doing, Tom?
I'm well. How are you, Stanley?
I'm getting better.
Good.
I wanted to talk about tribalism and death cults.
Okay, go for it.
I'm going to take it back to the beginning of when humans started congregating,
It started out as family groups, and then family groups grew up into tribes and tribal societies. Developed their own us-isms. Everything within our tribe is us, and everything outside the tribe is somebody else.
Right. And in fact, most indigenous people, if you ask them what the word for their tribe means, it's the word means human. That they're the first humans. We're all familiar with this as the Adam and Eve story. Adam is Hebrew for man, I believe. But back to you, Stanley.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go a little different direction than Adam and Eve on this. But from this, is racism has come out of this.
Out of tribalism. Yeah.
Tribalism, as well as many other us versus them attitudes and activities. And one of these activities is religion.
Mm-hmm.
With the largest ones opening their doors to different peoples in order to increase their power and influence.
Mm-hmm.
And in order to be given the goods of this life, in order to be given the power and influence in this life, without returning an equivalent value in this life, they promise a benefit after death.
Right. This was the sales pitch that white Americans gave to slaves back when slavery was going on here in the United States. Convert them all to Christianity. There were a lot of Muslims, actually, who came over as slaves. And then a lot of people who you might refer to as pagans, pantheists, whatever, convert them to Christianity so that they can all, you know, believe that if they're, you know, humble and, you know, if they follow the Sermon on the Mount kind of thing, the least among you shall be the first, that when you die, you will go to heaven.
Yeah, and they still and not go against their masters.
Right. Right.
Okay. So what we're looking at are basically death cults in religion, because a death cult is one that worships what happens after death.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't disagree, Stanley, and I think that this is one of the problems that we have with these Bronze Age and you know, more or less these archaic religions, and there's no shortage of them. The ones in particular that focus on what happens after death, I think Buddhism is, well, even Buddhism, they all have this kind of weird past that reflects, you know, cultures of olden times. We have a more modern time. I think it is possible for people to extract from their religion meaningful things and live them in today's life without following everything in the book. You know, you don't have to. You can be a good Christian or a good Jew and not follow the book of Jeremiah, or excuse me, the book of Joshua. Thank you, Shano. Where God said, go into Ai and kill every living person. I mean, you know, you say, hey, you know, that was then, this is now, you know, that was that God. I'm not sure that he's even still around, you know, it's like, or if he is, he's gotten with the act. But, you know, when religions revert back to that, as ISIS has done, then you've got a problem. I'm with you. Stanley, thank you for the call. It's very well said. Juan in Dallas, Texas. You want to try it again, Juan?
Oh, yes. Are you there?
Yeah, we're on the air.
Yeah, well, I called and trying to refer to the situation in Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
And the situation in Mexico is a very, very well managed in the United States. The way they do it, like in the 80s, 70s and 80s in Central America, they had the death squads. Now in Mexico, they got something they call encetas, which is really an army people from Mexico that was trained in the United States. Went back to Mexico and they claimed the disorder and they started their own situation. They really are what they're doing. There's a death squad that the Mexican government, with the blessings of the United States, used it to get rid of it, all the political enemies. In this case, anybody who wants human rights.
Mm-hmm.
And when a country like Mexico, when we buy tanks and weapons, we're not going to go and fight with Guatemala because Guatemala is not going to fight us, and we're not fighting the United States. So it's really to respect their own people, but because we claim in this case, in this part of the world, we claim, oh, everything's fine, blah, 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 Mexico, Swiss progress. Can you imagine if those killings take part in another country that is not so-called friends of the United States? The United States will be very critical into that.
Yeah.
And so that's what they call it in Mexico, the perfect dictatorship, and with the blessings. And anybody who really believes that Mexico has elections, that the president is not an appointee from the Washington, is really naive.
Yeah, no, Mexico has become an oligarchy and to some extent a kleptocracy, much like the United States, only much worse and much more rapidly. I'm with you on, and you know, if we want to be involving ourselves in the affairs of foreign countries in a positive way, maybe we should start next door. Juan, thank you for the call. Well said. Jerry in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, Jerry, says here you served several years in Iraq.
Yes, sir, I did. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to talk a couple points about what we were talking about earlier with the construction equipment that we did provide. It wasn't so much the case that people didn't know how to use it, that the people that did know how to use it didn't want anybody else to use it. You know, that goes back to the literacy rate and everything in the country.
Oh, it's because they were members of the Ba'ath Party, right?
Right, and to keep people uneducated, unskilled, you can keep control of them, and that's why they were not using those equipment.
Yeah.
Those equipment.
And the other guy was talking about Afghanistan. I mean, Afghanistan, it was, at the time we started bombing Afghanistan, it was the second poorest country in the world. It was one of the highest illiteracy rates in the world. It was the Stone Age. And, you know, we bombed them back to that. But, I mean, they literally built houses with stones. Iraq, on the other hand, was a fully modern society. Baghdad, you know, skyscrapers. I mean, it's a fully, or at least it was up until the first Gulf War. It was a fully modern society, highly functioning, and we destroyed it. But there was a high level of literacy in Iraq, and there was a high level of, you know, functional government. Yeah, it was dominated by the Ba'athist Socialist Party, but there was nothing like that, to the best of my knowledge, in Afghanistan. Back to you, Drew.
All right, well. I don't think the education rate's as high as some might think in Iraq. But as far as the people go, during the first Gulf War, I served during the first Gulf War as well as this round. After we left the first Gulf War, that upset the Iraqi people more than anything. They didn't want us to leave after that war. They wanted us to stay and finish.
Well, that was certainly true of the Shia in the South. And when President George Herbert Walker Bush told the Shia in the South, go ahead and rise up against Saddam Hussein and we've got your back. And they did. And then Bush was not able to get Congress or was not willing or whatever. I don't know why Bush didn't follow through on his promise. And Saddam Hussein came in and slaughtered 200,000-300,000 of these people. This was the Shia Sunni conflict.
So I know that.
Say what?
I dug some of the graves, so I'm very aware of that.
And it's a terrible thing. But again, it was American foreign policy that brought it about.
In part.
In part, yeah. Certainly, the hatred and tensions were always there. But you know, it's like had George Bush not said, "Yeah, go for it," and the people believed him. And then after that, I think American credibility just went to hell in the region. Jerry, thank you for the call, and thank you for volunteering to serve your country. I appreciate it. Thank you very much, and thanks for listening to Sirius XM Jacksonville. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls and the news of the day right after this. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you and Jesse in Miami. Hey, Jesse, what's up?
Hey, hi, Tom. Hey, I think capitalism is a cult, and it proves beyond any doubt it's a death cult. I would say this because we bailed out the system really twice, the last depression and this one.
Right.
And we bailed it out through the government.
Yep.
And And what is the thank you we get? Austerity. That's death in so many words. So you have a system that gives you a thank you like this. It's no wonder other people are looking for some other kind of cult, whatever definition you want to give it. But we save somebody's life, and the thank you we get is, oh, you know, you're not living right, or you live beyond your means, or, you know, you name it. And for McCain to call these people scum, trying to show some accountability to Kissinger, another death cult leader that makes, what's the guy, Jones in Guyana name, look like nothing.
Yeah, like a piker.
What do you, you know, what do you think? I mean, it's just, oh, well, a solution, I would say, Mr. Bernie Sanders or Ms. Warren, take Thomas Paine common sense to the Federal Reserve and say, look, you bailed out a death culture. Come on, we need to bail out ourselves.
Stop bailing out the capitalists and start bailing out the workers. I'm totally with you, Jesse. Thank you for the call. David in Shawnee, Oklahoma. Hey, David, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yes, sir, it's me.
Yeah. Welcome, David.
I'm honored to talk to you.
Thank you. Well, what's on your mind? You wanted to talk about ISIL?
Well, not really. ISIL ain't coming to get me. Coming to get you?
Not to the best of my knowledge, no.
I'm pretty sure they're not.
You know, that's fairly profound, actually, David. I mean, if that one piece of information was repeated on Fox News every 15 minutes for 3 or 4 days, they'd lose half their viewers because people wouldn't be terrified anymore. And, you know, our foreign policy would probably change. You know, ISIL, ISIS, whatever you want to call it, they're not coming to get us. You know?
No. Well, you know they're not, and I know they're not.
Yeah.
I can't talk. You were talking a couple of weeks ago about self-censorship.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I have censored myself. Still there?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Yeah, well.
So you have censored yourself, David, because the people around you are Fox brainwashed?
I'm not Fox brainwashed, but the people around me are.
Yeah. That's unfortunate. David, thank you for watching Free Speech TV in Shawnee, Oklahoma, and thank you for calling in. And, you know, your comments are a valuable contribution to the show. I appreciate it. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be back with more calls right after this. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you. And Mike in Fairfax, Virginia, listening on Sirius. It says here, you're wondering if the Democrats threw the last election to avoid dealing with ISIL?
Hey, thanks for having me on your show. Love it. I'm wondering if the foreign policy was anywhere on their radar in the last, on the last election, because it seemed to me that the Republicans capitalized a lot on the fears of on the irrational fears of ISIS and, quite frankly, Muslims in general. And it seemed to me that the Democrats were focusing so much on how they're not like Obama instead of pushing back against the Republicans on that. And it was just mystifying to me that you see this blatant discrimination against a group of people.
Yeah.
And here are the Democrats going, well, we're not like Obama. Well, the Republicans are already saying they're not. So if you're given a choice between two people, you know, who are you going to vote for?
Yeah, no, you're echoing Harry Truman. I mean, Harry Truman said, and he was talking about the Alison Lundgren Grimes types of Democrats who's, you know, she campaigned on, I'm not a Barack Obama. I disagree with Barack Obama. Vote for me. And she was running against Mitch McConnell, who was saying, I'm not like Obama either, and not only do I dislike him, but I've stopped him in his tracks. Vote for me.
Exactly.
And what Harry Truman said was, if people are given a choice between voting for a Democrat who behaves like a Republican or voting for a real Republican, they'll vote for the real Republican every time. I would say, you know, the opposite is true as well. You know, if they're given the choice of voting for a Republican who behaves like a Democrat or a real Democrat, they will vote for the Democrat every time. The problem is, a lot of Democrats in the last election didn't behave like Democrats. As you correctly pointed out, they said, we're just not Republicans, which is not enough.
Exactly.
You've got to have an affirmative, campaign, and hopefully we'll see that in 2016. Mike, thanks for the call. David in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Hey, David, what's up?
Hi, Tom. This is the first time I've ever called you.
Well, thank you. What's on your mind?
Do you know who the ultimate tribalists were? Go ahead, guess.
Well, you could track the Jews back as
right,
an early tribe.
You're right.
Although the Hindus, actually, there's a fair amount of evidence that the Hindus emerged at least 1,000 years before the Jews.
Yeah. Well, that could be. But in any case, the ancient Hebrews massacred entire populations in the name of their
David, family. Your phone has just gone crazy. I can't hear you. Do you have your thumb over the microphone or something?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. The ancient Hebrews massacred entire populations in the name of their tribal deity, Yahweh. Not only that, I mean, the Amalekites, the Midianites, the Canaanites, it's all in the Old Testament. And not only that, but Yahweh specifically ordered the ancient Hebrews to murder the children.
Yeah. David, you're fading out to the point where I can't hear it, but I agree with you that the Bible is filled with genocide. God ordered genocide. And anybody who sits around going, our religion, our Judeo-Christian religion is better than the rest of their religions because, you know, we don't kill people anymore. Well, it's in our holy books. It is promoted by the God of our holy books. And, you know, we have to come to terms with that. Thank you, David, for the call. But we've gone beyond that, and we need to help the rest of the world go beyond that, too. Rita in Washington, D.C. Hey, Rita, what's up?
Hey, I was just calling to expand on what you were talking about earlier, repurposing military dollars to lend support to these disenfranchised populations because,
right.
You know, just the crux of the anger that has emerged from not only the Middle East but from all over the world. It's all about food and shelter and education. And these populations, this is a perfect opportunity to bring green technologies and green specialists into these areas. And we have so many in this country who could work in an integrated manner with those who are already into the quick and dirty ways of building, you know, with Cobb and Adobe and Mud. And yeah, you've probably heard of Mike Reynolds with Earthship, right?
Yep.
Have you heard of him?
Yep. Yeah, I have my friend Dennis Weaver, he's passed along, but he used to live in an Earthship.
Right. I went to tour that. I took seminar at Mike Reynolds, and we went up to Dennis's home.
Oh, that's incredible. I wrote the foreword to Dennis Weaver's autobiography, The Whole World's a Stage.
Oh, really?
I knew Dennis for decades. He and Jerry were just wonderful, wonderful people.
Wow, it's really too bad he's gone because he was a great advocate.
Yeah.
And
But you're absolutely right, Rita. I have been in African countries where people who have never seen oil, coal, or natural gas, they never got into the carbon cycle. They've been using twigs, right, for fires to cook on, and they'd been carrying water miles and miles. You put up a solar panel and a small pump and drill a well and use that solar panel to provide lighting and heating and cooking, and all of a sudden they're in the 21st century. They leapfrogged right from the 18th century to the 21st century just like that. And we could do that for pretty much everybody in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, whatever, for a fraction of what we're spending on F-35s and bombs and all this military insanity.
I know. We need to take that approach. That's the compassionate heart approach. And actually, it puts them fast-forwarded way beyond us because we have to go back to that kind of level of consciousness where we turn down the volume on all this using up the sequestered carbon that we have.
Right.
And also there's the Arcasanti guy. There's another guy, Cal Art. And they're using that method where you put the the concrete or the adobe into those burlap bags.
Right.
You may have seen that as well.
Yep.
I'm just calling to, oh yeah, and with the agriculture and also the communications with the cell tech, the cell technologies and the satellite technologies, they don't have to deal with being wired.
That's right. You can build cell phone networks that are solar powered, particularly in those parts of the world. You're absolutely right, Rita. And the thing is that those industries don't have the kind of money to lobby and thus buy members of Congress. Thank you for the call, Rita. And thus buy members of Congress that the defense contractors do, because the defense contractors have been around for centuries, and they have certainly many, many decades, and they've got their hooks really deep into the political system, particularly since our Supreme Court has said it's perfectly legal to buy as many politicians as you want and wholly own them. Anyhow, thanks for being with us these 3 hours. We will be back tomorrow. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. Tag your ass. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.